Well, hi, welcome to our interview section of Power Talk. And today I'm very excited about having Captain Gerald Coffey with us. Many of you have heard me talk about him and maybe read about him in some of the newsletters where I've referenced his story. He's the gentleman who spent almost 7 years in a good deal of solitary confinement in Vietnam. But more importantly than that, his ability to come back and communicate that experience to people and relate it as a life experience, an experience in trust, an experience in faith, an experience in how a human being can find out what they're really made of and what you and I are capable of in our lives if we just utilize our inborn abilities is fantastic. And he's a man who really walks his talk. And as those of you listening know, that's probably the most important thing for me. He's a man who doesn't just talk about the ability to really have faith, but I've seen him live it, and I've seen the way he treats other people. And over the last couple of years, I've had the privilege of getting to know Jerry, and all I can say is very much like a Ken Blanchard or very much like Warren Farrell, this man has a message that needs to be heard by a large number of people. And his book, Beyond Survival, that tells the story of his POW experience and how he turned things around within himself, it's now in 4 languages around the world, and I wanted to make sure that you heard his message personally as well. So I really appreciate your coming back and taking the time to chat with us, Jerry, and welcome.
Tony, it's my privilege. I'm glad to be a part of your program here in Hawaii, on Maui, and extend to you my aloha as well.
Thank you very much. We've certainly enjoyed being here. I thought we might be start out right from the beginning. You know, most people have these fantasies, especially since Top Gun, about what it would be like to be a jet fighter, a pilot. And I'm curious, what made you want to become a jet pilot in the first place? Give me a little background, if you would.
Tony, I was born and raised, well, in 1934 through 41, of course, as a youngster. Then World War II came along. And as a youngster, that was a part of my upbringing. And I was, you know, I built model airplanes and model tanks and collected Army insignia and so on. And World War II and that whole era was a very strong part of my growing up consciousness. But even with that, I had never developed any, you know, strong driving desire to become a jet pilot or anything like that. As a matter of fact, while I was an art major down at UCLA, I was driving back to, actually I was hitchhiking back to school from my home in Modesto in Central California one day, and a couple of Air Force F-84 fighters came across the highway, Highway 101, and into a very sharp, smart break to land at the little auxiliary field in Van Nuys. And I watched that, and I really kind of got a little tingle in the back of my neck, and I thought to myself, I wonder if I'm missing out on something.
Aha!
And then it sort of just laid fallow for a while, and I graduated from college in 1957, as I mentioned, as an art major and a PE minor, and I got my draft notice. And I didn't mind serving in the military, but I wanted to have a little more control over my life, so I looked around at some of the alternatives. I remembered those jet fighters that I'd seen, and naval aviation looked exciting, so I took the physical down at Los Alamitos and passed, and by golly, signed up for the Navy. And I guess because I like the looks of the beaches at Pensacola, I decided to go Naval Air. That was the clincher, being the beach bum art major I was on Santa Monica. See?
Real destiny choice. Huh?
Right. And I've since learned that our ultimate destiny can be formed by some really weird choices made on strange bases.
Well, it sounds like you made similar choices to be back here in Hawaii as well.
Well, that's right. The really deep, deep desire to be on the beach won out after 28 years as a naval officer.
Oh, my gosh. Well, tell me a little bit about naval school. I know a lot of people certainly fall out, and they never make it through that process. I know it's a tough process. What pulled you through those times?
I think the fact that I've always been interested in athletics and been the classic red hot of whatever I was involved in, very enthusiastic and involved in student government in high school and early college, very competitive. And when I find myself in pre-flight at Pensacola, I really enjoyed what I was doing. Of course, you're graded on military bearing, and you're graded on academics, and you're graded in physical education, physical training. And those three aspects seemed to combine for me the very essence of what brought out my best.
Right.
Besides that, I really enjoyed the people that I was working with. And I started, went through my training and got my wings in 1959 and made my first deployment on the Navy's newest aircraft carrier and the Navy's hottest jet. And I thought I was Tom Cruise and Top Gun, you know, you couldn't touch me. Or any one of my contemporaries. Every one of us had to think we were the best carrier pilots that ever came down the pike. Otherwise, you couldn't make carrier landings and takeoffs day and night in all weather and do it safely and with confidence. And I realized that I really enjoyed what I was doing, and there wasn't anything else on the outside that I could foresee that I would enjoy more. So when the option came to either get out after the first 5 years or re-enlist and go regular, I chose the latter. And that led to a 28-year career the bulk of which I look back with very warm memories. Even the time in prison in North Vietnam, the 7 years and 9 days, as bad as they were, the way that I have been able to turn it around and form a more positive result, outcome from it, I wouldn't trade any of those 28 years, Tony, for anything else that I might have done.
That's fantastic. Did you think you were invincible back then? Before
sure.
you were shot down?
Sure. Of course. And of course, that invincibility becomes tempered with age and maturity. But even at that, the subtitle for the presentation that I've been giving for many years is The Invincibility of the Human Spirit.
Right.
And of course, by invincibility, as you know, I don't mean that you always win.
Right.
The invincibility comes with how you take the setbacks and whether you allow yourself to stay down. But to the contrary, how you bounce back and go at him again. And really, that was the essence of our resistance posture in North Vietnam. You never won every battle, and you never perform your duty perfectly. But the essence of your success and your performance of duty was how you bounce back.
Right.
And didn't yield to them, didn't surrender to their will, and to say in some kind of a definitive way, okay, you've got me, I give up, what do you want from me? You'd always, always gather your strength, take a big breath, lick your wounds and go back and start from scratch again every time you had to.
I think it's an important way of defining invincibility, because I think for most people, invincibility is they never get knocked down, and I don't think that exists.
No, you know. I don't either. It would be unrealistic.
Yeah. If you would, let's share with the listeners your day, the ultimate day for a lot of people, and the day you were shot down. Can we describe it a little bit and what happened?
Sure. For me, it was started out as a very routine day on an attack carrier in the Tonkin Gulf, working off the coast of North Vietnam. As it turned out, it was the last day on the line before the Kitty Hawk, the ship I was on, was to leave the Tonkin Gulf and go up to Hong Kong for 10 days of liberty,
R&R.
You know,
how ironic.
You know all those years in prison.
I know what you were thinking about.
Those 10 days of liberty that I was missed out on. But on the other hand, you can be sure I've made up for that several times over since then.
I bet you have.
So we were on the last launch of that day, and my crewman and I were joking about how we're going to spend our money or spend our time in Hong Kong, and not in the least believing that we wouldn't come back and make the recovery cycle of that same mission. As it turned out, we were hit over the central part of North Vietnam on that mission by light anti-aircraft fire, and ended up losing control of the airplane because of a loss of hydraulic power. And had to eject from the airplane at very high speed, totally out of control.
How fast was that?
Well, the last speed I saw indicated in the cockpit was about 680 miles an hour. So as I say when I speak, if you can imagine standing up in the backseat of your convertible at 680, bombing down the interstate highway there, you have some small idea of the impact. But it knocked me unconscious, and when I regained consciousness, the Vietnamese communists were bearing down on me in boats already and were shooting at us. My crewman survived the ejection, but he didn't survive the battle for our capture, which took place afterwards. We were strafed by our own airplanes from the Kitty Hawk, not realizing that we'd been taken into the boats that they were strafing.
Right.
And the whole thing was very confusing. And yet, because I had been unconscious for some time, I was in a state of shock and wasn't able to register the emotion of fear, really. It was just watching sort of a black and white movie of the whole thing flash by me in some kind of detached manner. And it wasn't until several hours later that I was able to really put myself into the context of what was going on, and then it began to get kind of spooky when I could say, you know, I can't believe this is happening to me.
Yeah. It's
supposed to happen to the other guy, otherwise I wouldn't have left the aircraft carrier that day, or I would have found some good reason to down my airplane for maintenance, you know, before taking the cat shot.
What was it like when you first made it to Wallo Prison?
Well, you know, we form our opinions of what it's going to be like to be a POW by Hollywood to a great extent. And even though I had three or four intensive days of training in my POW and survival training as a naval officer, you still think it's going to be like Steve McQueen had it in The Great Escape or Hogan's Heroes or Stalag 17, you know, where you're all together in a big compound, a big barbed wire fence, and everybody can laugh and scratch together when you could. So when I reached Hanoi and they threw me into a dungeon-like cell at Hoa Lo Prison, which was built by the French during the days of colonialism, and if you remember the movie Papillon with Steve McQueen and the big old French prison in which he was held in French Guiana, it was grim. I mean, I never in my wildest dreams envisioned what it could possibly be like. And then, of course, the solitary confinement for many, many years after that was something that we hadn't anticipated or could you possibly be trained for. But that in itself constituted challenges, the answers to which really continually amaze myself, and we amazed each other by how we were able to rise to those challenges. Just the very fact, for example, Tony, that back on the shoot down, when I had been unconscious for a certain length of time, and while unconscious had been able to release my oxygen mask and my parachute harness, inflate my flotation gear, and to all of this with a broken arm and dislocated shoulder and so on, all those capabilities were within me. And I began to derive my first insight as to the capabilities that we possess without even realizing it.
Right.
And then as the experience unfolded, I began to realize how tough I was physically, and how that if you have an injury, a broken arm or a broken limb or something, or bad burns or cuts, if they're not treated for months, you don't die. You know, but
right.
We in our society, our standard of living is so high, and we see a doctor immediately, generally, if we're injured or something, and you don't know what's going to happen if you're not treated. And I began to develop a huge appreciation for my physical toughness and stamina, as anybody would if they're put in the same circumstances. I began to realize the same things applied emotionally as well. You find defense mechanism. You begin to almost subconsciously begin to live in shorter increments of time.
Tell me about that, because I know we had a conversation once before. You told me something about how you lived it 6 months at a time or something like
exactly,
that?
Because the nature of the situation in Vietnam was such that we could be released because of a political settlement or maybe a military victory in the South. But I've since realized that it's nothing new. The Alcoholics Anonymous, their slogan is one day at a time. Anytime that you can break down any adversity into increments, smaller pieces of time, it tends to be easier, much more manageable, of course.
How did you manage, though, to keep saying 6 more months each time 6 months went by? Is it like running and you get to your target and you say, oh, I can do more?
That's exactly right. Essentially, that's an excellent comparison, because there were times, Tony, I'd been there for 2 years, for example, and I said to myself, man, if I'm here on the 5-year mark, I'm going to cross over. never believing my wildest dreams that I'd still be there in 5 years. But of course, 5 years came along, and I was no more inclined to cross over than I would have been the first year.
Sure.
And every anniversary, every birthday, every Christmas, every Easter, you'd be communicating with a guy next door, and you'd convince one another, without question, man, this is the last one here. But home for next Christmas, home for next Easter, home for next birthday. And you believe that. You'd really believe it.
Now, but weren't there guys that didn't?
Not many. And you know, I think that...
Is that because of the support of each other? Or
to a great extent, the support, the community that we built up. And I've tried to cover that and describe it in the book. And apparently, I did a pretty good job, because Scott Peck, the author of
yes.
The Road Less Traveled, of course,
yes.
Gave me a very warm testimonial. And I smiled when I referenced it, because he said if I wanted to use it, I had to use it in its entirety, because it starts out with... Although Captain Gerald Coffey and I disagree almost diametrically on our involvement in Vietnam, nevertheless, his book tends to describe better than anything I've ever read the ability of men to come together in community in the face of adversity.
Yeah,
and
I have to agree with him, no doubt about it.
And it's remarkable, I think, the mechanisms that exist for all of us. You don't have to be in prison together. The mechanisms that exist for us in a family, in a community, on any kind of a team, a joint effort, all those same dynamics apply. And you know, these are the very same precepts that you teach as well. So the ways to get through these adversities exist for us physically, emotionally, intellectually. We're so much smarter than we think we are. We've remembered so much the more than we think we've remembered, all of which contribute to our ability to survive these kinds of circumstances, and not just survive, as the book implies, but to go beyond survival. I mean, we all can survive. But it depends on what you do with that survival, how you build upon those adversities and how you grow from them is what I mean by going beyond survival.
I think the only way to get beyond survival is start beyond it.
And I think, good point. To be spring-loaded to the beyond survival,
yeah.
Huh?
And I think that that's really what you did. You know, from when I read your book, and I see that what you did as a community is get people to start in that place. And I think one of the biggest challenges that people have in life is they don't discover who they really are, because they never have to. Yeah. And stretching, the philosophy of doing whatever it takes, you know, stretching, if you can't do something, then you must, is a way to, I think, to get people in advance to discover who they really are. Because I think if you don't find out who you really are, if you don't stretch yourself, life will show up and find a way to stretch you personally.
You know, that's a great concept, is to preposition yourself beyond survival. And physically,
right.
You know, the obvious point there is to be in good shape.
Right.
So that if you meet a physical challenge, you're already halfway there. Emotionally, to be centered, to have your life in order, to develop self-confidence and esteem like you do when you land on aircraft carriers at night.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, you know, in a way, it's never been articulated that way, but in a way, the majority of us who had to go through that experience were pre-positioned
right.
beyond survival in the first place. And off into the experience, we began to realize that.
Yes.
And thank the system and our ability to embrace that system and to believe in it for helping us to do that.
I'm a big believer, as you know, that our core beliefs, our global beliefs about life, ourselves, people, et cetera, are what shape our decisions of how to feel about things, what things mean to us, and what we should do. What were some of the core beliefs that helped you to really make it through that time? I mean, first of all, you might allude, if you would, to the size of your cell. I know I can visualize it from what you've described, yeah. but I'm remembering.
Well, the cell in which I found myself there in Wallow was about as a little narrower, actually, than a single bed, about
right.
a little over 3 feet wide, and about 6.5 feet long. And along one wall, jutting out from one side, was a concrete slab about 20, 22 inches wide. That was my bed. Ankle stocks at the foot of it with a huge, big iron manacle that came down across the top of your ankles and locked with a rusty padlock, which they would use liberally to punish you. There was one tiny window in the back wall of the cell with a double row of iron bars. And all you could see through the bars were the little shards of broken glass on top of the 16-foot wall that went around the entire city block-sized prison. A small tin bucket in one corner of the cell that didn't have a lid, but that was what you were to use to take care of all your physical needs and relief. And the cell just reeked of the human misery that had been there before I had been there. I mean,
yeah.
in a prison like this, you know, it was decades of human misery. And if the walls could have possibly talked, they would have told some incredible stories of misery and courage, guilt, hardship, death probably.
Yeah.
Totally different than anything that my training could have prepared me for.
So what made you make it through that time in terms of beliefs? I know you talk about faith, but if you were to break that faith into beliefs, what are some of those core beliefs?
I think that one of my core beliefs was a belief in a greater power.
Right.
Certainly a core belief in my spiritual practice, or should say maybe my practice in spirituality before having been shot down as a Christian in my case, and having lived my life in the context of a Christian environment with that kind of structure, I think provided a fine basis for faith in general. I was speaking recently and a lady asked me how she could best prepare her children to be able to embrace the kinds of faith that I was espousing during that lecture. And I suggested that spiritual faith in the first place,
yeah.
to be raised in a spiritual environment with that kind of structure and order and discipline, relating to our natural environment, our planet, our ecology, the rules of nature, the laws of nature. I mean, if a person is having trouble keeping or believing in faith or embracing the concept of faith, all one needs to do is to look at our world.
Right.
I mean, how simplistic can we get? But I mean, we have faith that the sun's going to rise and set each day, and that's the beginning. If you can't believe in anything else, you can believe in the way our world works and the way the creation evolves. And we, being simple elements of that creation, have the same kind of dynamics and the same reasons to keep faith in ourselves and the sources of strength that exist within each of us. And even though, as you pointed out, we too seldom have occasions to tap those sources of strength. And you don't wish adversity on anybody,
no,
on the one hand, but on the other hand, you kind of feel for people who don't have occasions to mine those depths of strength and sources of comfort and reassurance and esteem and growth. Faith in one another, Tony. Gosh, the ways that we created communities in those circumstances, mostly by tapping through the walls without ever seeing men face to face, and yet developing relationships and means of communication and sincerity and empathy that often we can't even develop face to face in our
yeah.
daily lives right here.
Yeah.
Which gives me a reason to really stop and wonder, what is wrong with us here? You know, why can't we develop this? And then the third aspect of faith that I try to emphasize is faith in our country, our environment, another one of my core beliefs, that my country and the kind of environment that it provides and the forms of justice and democratic process and the belief in human dignity, those core values and beliefs made my sacrifice worthwhile to to be making the sacrifices in the name of something like that, to believe that our cause in those circumstances was just, for example. Maybe it was lucky for me that I was shot down relatively early in the war and became a prisoner before so much of the anti-war rhetoric became so universal in our country, although it wasn't literally universal, but sometimes I know it seemed like that in comparing notes and talking with people later on. But I truly believed in our cause there, and that made my sacrifice and the pain and the misery and all the things that were necessary to go through more meaningful to me.
Right.
And then, as I mentioned when I talked to your people a few nights ago, when my prayers changed from, "Why me, God?" which of course is kind of non-productive and useless, from "Why me?" to "Show me."
Right.
Show me what I'm supposed to do with this. I mean, what are you preparing me for? I wouldn't be here for no reason. I'm supposed to use this to pick up on it. And I began to realize that I was developing an incredible responsibility there to embrace the insights that come from that kind of adversity, just as I would hope that anybody who suffers any kind of adversity, or you could say enjoys any kind of adversity, here at home.
Nice reframe.
You know, your ultimate reframe, right. To embrace that adversity, because you know that it's going to provide for you insights and lessons and capabilities that you wouldn't have had before otherwise.
Right.
But it also implies a responsibility to not only go beyond survival with them yourself, but to help others to go beyond survival in their own lives as well, and to perpetuate those insights and capabilities.
I agree with you. I think a couple things fired off in my mind while you were talking. One was, do you feel the same way about the war today? Because there's so much mixed emotion about it. You know, you watch movies and television, and I was a young boy wondering whether I was going to be drafted. I wasn't quite old enough yet,
sure.
Wondering how long the war was going to go. So I don't have the references you have. And it's, hindsight is always 20/20 for the people looking back. But you've been through the experience. You've experienced as much pain as anybody could. What are your feelings about the war, what it meant, and what it means to us today, and what can we learn from it?
When I answer that question, I'm always aware of what would be a natural propensity for me to rationalize my experience so that I wouldn't think that I'd gone through all that for nothing. So having said that, and as objectively and intellectually as I can analyze the war and where we are now because of it, my convictions have been nothing but strengthened since the war, since I've been out and had a chance to look at it from with hindsight and in the context of what's happening in our world today. I believe that we as Americans enjoy the responsibility, if you will, of putting our money where our mouth is when necessary, in backing up our convictions throughout the world, in fulfilling the responsibility that comes through our leadership and through our strength, not just military strength, but our economic and social strength as well, our moral strength, if you will, to a certain extent, and that we were there for good reason, and we were there to help other people who have similar beliefs and hopes for their future to achieve those hopes and beliefs. I do maintain great reservations about the war, way the war was pursued. I think it was pursued very wrongly, very ineptly, and I attribute that to the political leadership that existed during the time. In spite of the fact that we didn't achieve our primary objective there for the people of South Vietnam to help them achieve their own destiny, it doesn't change the fact that millions of people in Southeast Asia right now in those otherwise domino countries are living in relatively free and democratic societies right now because of our 10 years of involvement, our holding action against the incredible momentum of Chinese and North Vietnamese communism combined in those mid-60s, early 70s. And that our presence there, our sacrifices, and our effort did make an incredible difference. And I would suggest further that when we see the opening up of Eastern Europe, the crumbling of communism, the rise of democracy in Central America, I think that these are all indications that our policies and that our strategy throughout the 50 or 60 Cold War years that have preceded it have been valid. And these are a vindication of that strategy in spite of the fact that we've had doubts, we've done things wrong, we screwed up a lot of things. But I think that generally speaking, we were in fact on the right track. And all this wouldn't have happened in a vacuum. It's due in great part to our national strategy over the last 50 years.
I think you said it well the other night when you said that wall that we see in Washington, D.C. is tied to another wall that's come down in Germany.
That's right.
And, I think many times when people look at something and they look at what is the cause of it, they look for what seems to be happening simultaneously that seems to be unique and different, rather than looking at maybe something was set in motion a long time ago. And it's an interesting perspective, to say the least. Do you think, and the same definition of invincibility that you gave for yourself would be true of our country, i.e., that invincibility doesn't mean that we don't make mistakes, but that we bounce back, that we learn from them? How do you relate that philosophy to a nation?
I think that each individual is in a microcosm of his or her country. And the same, I would suggest the same dynamics apply. And by all means, you said it, invincibility for a country doesn't mean that you win every battle or that you don't make mistakes, but it's your purpose. It's your driving force. It's your ethic. It's what makes you tick that makes the difference. Why you do the things that you do, the outcomes that you have in mind are the things that are important. And in this, in striving for those outcomes, you don't always make the right decisions, because our country is made up of humans and there are human failings and shortcomings. And we need to give ourselves slack, just like we need to give our country slack. And we get, you know, our media, I think, tends to get wrapped up in bashing our country and our leadership, expecting perfection when it's totally unrealistic. I think the important thing is to look at the trend and the long-term effect of our strategies and policies and see what we are able to accomplish, just as we do as our, with ourselves as individuals.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Not everybody does that. Some people look at the moment and decide that's who they are, rather than looking at the direction they're heading and the ultimate destiny they're creating for themselves
and
their actions.
You know, one of the things, one of my friends, a fellow speaker, Patricia Fripp, maybe you know of her, we were having dinner one night and we were talking about the kind of the dynamics of this thing. And she said, well, and she speaks with this British accent, you know, well, no wonder coffee, people listen to what you say. How many people have had 7 years just to think about what they think? That kind of took me aback. And I thought about that and referenced it since then. But, you know, truly, how, you know, in our busy, busy routines, Tony, we seldom have a day with no radio, telephone, television, memos, newsletters, newspapers, no interruptions, just to think about ourselves and who we are and what we are and how we got to where we are and what our capabilities and strengths and potential are. And I think that's one of the valuable things that you and your programs provide, as a matter of fact, is you get people out of their normal context. And as intense as your program is, nevertheless, you provide opportunities for reflection and introspection and an environment for a person to really kind of get into themselves for a change, which is something that's so rare in our daily routine. And man, when you got 7 years to do it, one of the first things you learn is that you're human.
Yeah. And you a concept, huh?
Isn't that revolutionary, right? That we're human and that embraces all the things that go into our human psyche and our failings and our capabilities and our emotions and so on. And you begin to appreciate the wonder of ourselves, number one. You begin to appreciate our humanness and give ourselves slack and quit expecting perfection and to realize that it's all part of the whole.
Yeah.
And how beautiful it all blends together. And who'd want perfection anyway?
Sounds really pretty boring to me.
Very boring.
Well, the truth is, I think most people are threatened by somebody supposedly perfect. And if they're perfect,
that's
they're probably
right.
not showing their whole self anyway.
That's exactly right. And you know, I think somebody who comes across as perfect, and we've both seen people on the platform, I think, who come across as so perfect that you can't relate to them.
Right.
And I think that loses some effectiveness because people can't, they're not approachable. People can't relate to them. And they stay up on this kind of pedestal, this kind of professional pedestal as a perfect professional speaker or lecturer or trainer or a perfect hero or whatever. And I think it undermines their credibility.
I agree. Well, and also, at the very least, it makes people say, well, that person can do it, but I can't.
Yeah.
And that person's special.
Yeah.
And one of the beauties about your story and your way of communicating that I really love and respect about you is that you step off that pedestal also. You get out there and say, look, this is your story. It's not my story. It's our story. You know, and you would have done the same thing. And I think a lot of people say, I don't know if I could have done what he did. But at the same time, I think you make it believable by the way you go about it, by teaching that it's really basic fundamentals of faith and belief. And one of the things that I teach a lot about is that what directs our whole life, obviously, is how we feel, how we feel is based on what we focus on, and what we focus on is based on the questions we ask ourselves habitually. And so I was really interested when we first met, and you mentioned it again just earlier, that you said when you kept saying, why me? I teach people why questions are endless loop questions. You know, it's just right. Like, why right. me? Well, because I'm an idiot. Why me? Because I deserve it. You know, why me? Because, you know, I was designed to do this. Versus when you ask, you know, how do I do something? You know,
right.
What do I need to do to turn it around? How can I turn it around? So I'd be really curious if I could take you back for a moment. What were some of the questions you asked yourself? Did you ask yourself any disempowering questions that you remember? I hallucinate. You must have asked a few. And maybe a better question is, what are the questions you asked yourself in there that kept you on track? Well, that was one of them. You gave me a real key there. I'm wondering if there are any others that you can remember you asked yourself when you're thinking to yourself for these 7 years. You know, what kind of things did you ask yourself if you started to get off track that got you back on track? For example, you asked, what's my purpose here? What am I... You know, show me the way.
Yeah.
What do I need to do?
Yeah, okay. One of the questions which I alluded to earlier was, is the sacrifice that I'm making right now, is the effort that I'm making worthwhile?
Yeah.
I mean, is my cause really just?
Right.
And frankly, having lived in, being having the opportunity, if you will, to live in a communist system, literally, albeit in prison, but as I point out, it wasn't that much different on the outside of the prison walls in a communist society, frankly.
Right.
Is it really worthwhile? And honestly, the longer I was there, every single day that I was there, my convictions were reaffirmed.
Right.
And indeed, it was worthwhile when I was able to see and appreciate firsthand the nature of communism and the hold that it has on its people and the nature of the ideology and the lies and slander and deceit that were necessary to motivate these people to do what they were doing. So one of the questions that I'd ask myself frequently, is this really worth it? And the answer I kept coming back with, yeah, it is. Look around you. Look at the alternative. Look what you're fighting. This is it, man. It's around you each day. So that's an advantage that most Americans don't have the chance to experience, obviously, fortunately,
yeah.
is the true day-to-day nature of communism. We look at it as some kind of ethereal thing that exists in other countries, and it's...
Or it's made up by the media.
Or it's made up by the media, right? Well, it can't be all that bad, you know. I don't know if I'd rather be dead than red, and wait a minute now, you know.
Right.
Or you talk to youngsters, for example, who say, well, man, I'd be the first to fight for my country if we're invaded. But I don't think we should be involved in Central America or wherever, you know. And the point is there that communism is very, very insidious. And it isn't black or white. And its dangers are very well disguised sometimes in infiltration, in guerrilla warfare, in political chaos and political vacuum, that kind of thing. So that was one important question that kept me on track.
Makes sense.
Another important question was, who am I?
Great question.
What does my humanness mean? Am I really a reincarnation of my God? Is God really inside of me? Is it really one family under God? Am I really related to my Vietnamese brothers? Is there really a difference because his eyes are slanted and mine are round and his skin is yellow or brown and mine's not? And the answers from that question are really the ones that help me to emerge from the circumstance without much bitterness or hatred.
I was wondering about that.
Because
you were beat, you were physically...
Lots of, yeah. In the normal context of things, lots of reasons to be bitter or hateful.
Kidding.
But frankly, one of the most important lessons that I learned was that there was no reason to hate the Vietnamese. I mean, they just wanted the same basic things for them and their lives and their children that we do. And that it was the ideology that made the difference.
Well, obviously, I agree with you about your views of communism. I'm curious, from your perspective, what's great about America today?
The potential, for one thing. Some of the great things about America are the same things were great about America 200 years ago, Tony. We have an incredible system based upon an incredible constitution, and we have ups and downs, I think, depending upon the strength of our leadership. And to kind of turn the question around right now, I would say one of the most troubling things about America today is leadership. But I think one of the greatest things about America is the way that we can see ourselves grow and gradually, incrementally ascend to higher and higher levels of enlightenment right along with the rest of the human race. But I think one of the nice things is we tend to lead. And at the risk of sounding nationalistic and red, white, and blue, and even jingoistic, I think there's no question but what the rest of the world looks to us for leadership, to much of this path to enlightenment. And we don't have all the answers by any means. We have a lot to learn from other cultures in the world, other ethnic groups. Well, I say other ethnic groups. I mean, we're comprised of an incredible ethnic mix, and that's one of our strengths, one of the things that I like. Some people are scared by the prospects of having such a diverse ethnic mix in the next century, but I think it's something we should be excited about, and that it can work in our favor, and is already working in our favor, simply open our eyes to it. I think that I think the key to our future is our political leadership.
Well, what does good leadership look like to you?
I think good leadership is leadership with a vision. I think a good leader is somebody who can articulate to the American people, or to whomever it is that they may lead, can articulate the alternatives that we face, and where sacrifices and dedication are required, to articulate the need for the sacrifice, the parameters for that need, the fact that it will affect everybody equally, and that it won't last forever.
Right.
And I think if we have leadership that can simply explain that to the American people, which we didn't have during the Vietnam era, that the American people are willing to band behind any effort, whether it be in space, whether it be ecologically, whether it be militarily, if necessary, in the defense of our way of life and our belief system. I think that the leadership is the key. And unfortunately, it seems to me that particularly in our Congress, that we really are hurting for statesmanship as opposed to political process. And, you know, I'm not into Congress bashing by any means, because it's still a great system, and it works better than any other thing on earth, literally. But I think that we have come to interpret our Constitution too broadly, and that's caused great difficulties in maintaining law and order in our society. I think that, as I mentioned to one of the ladies in our Q&A the other night, that you can look at the decline in our overall moral system, the increase in drug and alcohol abuse, crime rates, suicides. You see that line going up disproportionately to the level of family values and basics of black and white moral values, spirituality, our ethical systems, the same in educational systems, going down proportionally. And it, to me, is no mystery. And when we see somebody getting wrapped around the axle about all these problems, about teenage pregnancies and drug and alcohol abuse and suicides, and yet they say that we don't need to worry about saying prayers before football games, to me, that's just burying your head in the sand, because there's a definite linkage there, definite coincidence.
A lot of it comes tied down, I think, to our focus on time. That there's a great deal more focus culturally on the short term instead of the long term. And when you look at the short term and you see there's pain there, which for long term pleasure, long term gain, for anything of substance, usually there is a price to be paid up front. When the only focus is, gosh, you know, how can I avoid pain right now?
Yes.
I think we make decisions in a way that in the long term hurts us. And that's the ultimate pain, because it shows up one day as what I call the Niagara syndrome, where, you know, you jump on the river of life, you don't know where you're going. You hit the forks in the river, and you've got so much momentum from everyone around you pulling you in a certain direction, and one day you find yourself 5 feet from Niagara Falls in the boat, no oars, and you say, oh, shoot. And it's late at that point, you know, morally or spiritually or physically or financially. But rarely do people take a look at the long term. They look at, well, how do I make sure that I stay where I am, keep what I have, you know, and hopefully make a little progress, rather than just saying, hey, I'm willing to bite down for the short term in order to have long-term substance and quality in my life. I'm curious, what do you think are the solutions for the future for us? What is it going to take for us as a country to move to the next level? We're in a unique time. And I know you and I have talked many times that we're at a crossroads, and we both have talked about that sounds so trite because it's so overused. But what do you think is going to take us to the next level? What are the choices and decisions that we have to make to be able to really take advantage of these times?
Again, not to beat a dead horse, but I think leadership is going to be critical.
Okay.
I think it's axiomatic that the more you hurt, the more willing you are to accept extreme measures. Of course, to the point of danger. I mean, we see evidence of that around the world historically. I think that the nature of some of the problems that we face from the standpoint of ecology, the standpoint of allocation of resources, and social ills are becoming so serious that we will be forced into making the right decisions.
Right.
And I find more and more openness to that. That's why in this kind of vast milieu of negatives, I see reason for optimism and excitement, because we as humans just like we have to hurt so much individually before we take action to change that, I think as a nation and as a world, as a planet, we have to hurt so much in order to take action to change that. I think where people like you and I and our advocates and the people that we have the privilege of affecting can make a difference is in maybe shortcutting some of that,
right,
and making it happen faster than it might have otherwise. And I know that you share the sense of responsibility with that. And it isn't just a profession. It isn't just a way to make a living, certainly, but it's a responsibility that comes with having evolved in our respective careers where you can affect the way people think.
Right.
And if we can channel those thought processes in good, positive ways, which improve our environment, then I think that we're fulfilling that responsibility. If we can translate that sense of responsibility to everybody else around us so that it's like a vast chain reaction of a sense of responsibility, I think that's the kind of thing that it's going to take.
I think it's also looking at responsibility as that, the ability to respond, rather than something heavy around your back that
yes.
says, oh my gosh, I got to go out and try and save the world. I think a lot of people are going to try and save the world and they haven't cleaned out their closet. You know, they haven't figured out how to make their family work. You know,
right.
They haven't learned how to conduct their own personal life and they say they want to change the world and they're all upset about everything else. I think a dual approach to making a difference starts with taking care of your own life, your own family, conducting yourself consistently with your own moral values before you can start pointing the finger at somebody else. And then when you have that kind of congruency, you can be looking at how to have that impact be extended. I also believe, as I think you do, that nothing like pain to motivate people. And the key is, hopefully what we can do is anticipate the pain enough that we get motivated in advance rather than having to wait till that pain comes to us.
Right. That's my mission in life, is to try to provide the kinds of insights where people don't have to be overcome by adversity to gain the insights that derive from,
right.
from adversity.
Right.
And so, as you say, kind of help people preposition themselves beyond survival rather than having to go through all the same pain and experiences that I did.
Well, you can learn by your own experience or other people's experience, and certainly one is a lot more pleasurable and time-saving.
Right.
Let me go back to that for just a second, if I can digress. Tell me, if you would, back in the times when you were in prison and so forth, please share with, you have already shared it with me, but if you'd share with our audience a little bit about the communication tools that you use, because as you said, it's so fascinating, the amount of creativity that went into it, for example, tap code, and the kind of relationship that was developed there. I'd be curious if you could just share a little bit of that. And how was that passed? Curious about that, since you guys couldn't really communicate in the beginning, and I didn't understand how that was passed
along. Well, since we're in solitary confinement so much of the time, and the only means to communicate with each other was by tapping on the walls from cell to cell, we developed a system that we called Tap Code, and it's really been around for centuries. It's nothing that we learned there or made up there. And as it turned out, the sixth man who was shot down out of almost 600 men had used it as a Boy Scout, and then as his survival instructor at Stead Air Force Base reaffirmed it, but sort of offhandedly. It wasn't a part of the syllabus. And he taught the other five guys to use it, and they agreed that they'd pass it to every other guy. And to do that, you'd maybe write a note on a piece of paper, and you might write with a burnt matchstick or a piece of red brick or something that would make a mark, and draw up the little matrix. And it was based upon 25 letters of the alphabet, throwing away the letter K. Arrange the remaining 25 letters in five rows of five letters each, one row on top of the other. As you look at this little square of letters, you have A through E across the top row,
right.
F through J in the second row, and so on, so on, so on, with Z down on the lower right-hand corner.
Right.
So you have five horizontal rows and five vertical columns of letters. To tap a letter, you tap the number of the row and you tap the number of the column. So since A is in the corner, first row, first column, A would be one tap and one tap, one and one.
Right.
B is first row, second column over, one and two. C, one and three, and so on. N is the letter right in the middle of the square, third row, third column, so you tap three and three.
Right.
And of course, Z down in the corner would be five and five. And in using this little system, we would abbreviate, and you would, when you're tapping out a word, the man who's receiving the word, as soon as he recognizes it, he'd give you a double tap, and you stop it and go on to the next one without even finishing. Seldom finish tapping out a whole word. And within the context of the conversation, you could abbreviate and leave out words, and it was just incredible, Tony, how much information would be passed in a very short time using this code. And you develop ways to do this by coughing and spitting and hacking and sneezing and choking sounds.
You shared some of that.
For one, numbers 1 through 5. And so you could develop this combination of human sounds, and you'd be communicating, literally, but the guard standing there would think you're just, you know, having a fit or dying of pneumonia or something like that.
What was the example you gave the other day? You were talking about a guy telling you about the Super Bowl.
Yeah, well, I was in a little courtyard one time waiting to be interrogated, and a new prisoner who was in an adjacent cell there had been shot down and brought into the comm system. And through a very high window, I could hear the guy coughing and sneezing and hacking and spitting. As I say, the guard probably thought he was dying of pneumonia, but he was really telling me that just before he had been shot down a couple months before, the Miami Dolphins had gone to the Super Bowl. And the irony was, of course, that at that point, I'd been shot down and in prison for so long at that point, I didn't even know what the Super Bowl was.
Wow.
Because it hadn't been when I was shot down.
Wow.
But it was just one example of the flexibility of the communication system. And you'd use the system so often and so consistently, and you'd be in communication with one man for so long, that you get to know his moods, his emotions. You'd know when he was sorry. You'd know when he was happy. You'd know how to do a little series of thumps and taps and fingernail scratches to simulate a laugh. If you liked
wow.
the joke that he told, you know,
wow.
or you'd have it made a kind of thump and a scrape for, you know, you got to be kidding me, buddy. You know, I don't believe that kind of. It's amazing the kind of emotions and feelings and moods that would come through a wall.
So when human beings have the need to communicate, they can always find a way, huh?
They always find a way. And again, that's the irony, is that we have so much difficulty communicating face-to-face sometimes right here at home, when it should be so much easier than we tend to make it.
I guess because we don't make important enough.
Priority, that's right. And also because it doesn't require the concentration. We take it, I think, less seriously.
Yeah, I guess if you're going to have to tap for about 30 minutes to get a few sentences
you
across,
get to the point.
You get to the point, you also think about what's really most important in the message. Huh?
That's right.
Well,
exactly.
Let's cut to that with you. Let me ask you, what would you say is the single most important lesson that you got from the 7 years that you had and you were incarcerated?
I think the single most important lesson that I derive from that whole experience is that we are really a lot tougher and more durable and capable than we generally tend to think we are. That we have resources within us, sources of strength that we never knew existed. That we have intellectual capacities that when given the opportunity to tap them, they just blow your own mind.
Yeah.
And that the really important things in life are spiritually based, and our own spirituality has derived from that sense and belief in a greater power, and how powerful we can be with that knowledge of our own spirituality, our own capabilities and strength. I think that all that derives from knowing yourself. We all possess the power that we need intrinsically to do what we need to do. And unfortunately, in our daily lives, we either don't have the inspiration or the example or the input or the time, the environment, to tap these resources to realize that they're there. And that's probably one of the most important lessons that I learned while I was there.
That's maybe the most important lesson in life, to know you already have all the resources you need. And I think we live in a society where there's so much distraction that we end up majoring in minor things.
Yeah,
and we don't focus on those things that have the lasting value.
And we begin to believe the alternative systems that people tend to put in our minds.
Yeah.
But if you develop the ability to focus inwardly and to realize the beauty of your own humanness and the power that that gives you, man, there's no room for guilt or lack of self-esteem or hatred, bitterness,
right.
Carrying a grudge, you know. There's just no room.
So what is life?
I'm glad you asked.
I'm serious. What is life? Tell me, what is it as a metaphor? What is it?
Life is here and now.
All right.
It doesn't matter if what's going on is good, bad, painful, if you're in just infinite joy. It doesn't matter if you are at your destination. I gave a presentation recently to MDRT, $1 Million Roundtable.
Right.
And when you're able to realize that there isn't any destination, that life is ongoing, and that what you think was a destination really becomes the leaping off point for your next goal.
Right.
That when you let go of one bar of the trapeze and you're turning around looking for the other one, that scary limbo in between is the best place to grow.
Yeah.
And that, as Richard Bach put it in his book, Illusions, the test of whether your mission in life is over, if you're still alive, I mean.
That's great. So how do you measure success in your life now?
Well, I've learned that just because you get shot down once doesn't mean it's the last time you're going to get shot down.
Yeah.
That's sort of...
I think it's a metaphor for anybody.
...is connected to... Yeah, we all get shot down sooner or later and sometimes more than once. And just because you survived the first one doesn't necessarily mean you're immune from having to go through it again or something similar again.
Well, it sounds like a real positive message people are going to love to hear.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's also called real, you know?
It's called life. Yeah,
that's what
life is.
That's right.
Life is a, you know, as I also pointed out in the speech, you try to make your takeoffs and landings come out even. But sometimes you get shut down.
And in between, you get to enjoy the fact that you fly instead of just sitting on the ground or crawling.
That's right.
And that's the part that people sometimes forget. Sometimes they remember the crashes. Well, they remember the takeoffs that didn't do so well.
Takeoff.
And they forgot about all the flights that they had.
That's right. How do I measure success in my own life? More basically than before, if you will, I measure success in my own life by the continuing realization that I'm always doing the best that I can, that I won't win them all, that I enjoy the ones that I do win. But the important thing is that I'm always progressing, that I'm always reaching a higher level of enlightenment, of talent, of effectiveness, of sharing, of self-knowledge. To me, that's success. Because if I continue to measure success by some of my old standards, I wouldn't be doing as well.
Yeah, you'd have a lot of pain.
A lot of pain. And by old standards, I don't mean that I've rationalized into lower standards,
I
mean that I think that through maturity you tend to focus upon more realistic and more substantial standards.
Maybe standards with more depth.
Yeah. Yeah.
What makes you happy now?
My granddaughter. Being in love. Receiving love. Love's the bottom line, Tony.
That's great.
It is. I think I'm the happiest when I'm with my granddaughter, who's now 15 months old and has introduced an entirely new dimension into my life, and particularly under the circumstances of her father dying just a week or so after her birth. And I'm the happiest when I'm creating with somebody that I love and enjoying the fruits of that creation with somebody else. I think those are a couple of my most basic measures of happiness.
What would you say you're most proud of in your life so far?
My children. I'm most proud of my life, of the way my children have come out, the things that they've learned, both because of me and maybe in spite of me.
That's a pretty honest way of looking at things.
And the relationship that we have been able to maintain in spite of some painful times for all of us, one-on-one, four-on-one, but the way that we've evolved in our relationships, that you transcend the father-son, father-daughter relationship and evolve into true friendships with appreciations for one another as human beings out of the context of father-daughter, father-son.
Right. As long as we're talking about children, since you've had plenty of pain, which means you probably had plenty of learning,
and right?
And you've also had plenty of love, or you wouldn't be in the position that you are as a human being and have the family you have. What's one of the most important lessons you've learned in that arena, besides the idea of transforming into friendship? What is a lesson that you would try to give your children today, or you'll want to give your granddaughter? Is there a particular lesson or belief that somehow you want to pass on? And make a part of her upbringing and growth and expansion as a human being, as a spirit?
Yes, but probably somebody else said it better than I when they said all I ever needed to learn, I learned in kindergarten, is to help my granddaughter Amy to not outgrow the beautiful wonder of youth and appreciation of our world and the creation around us, to continue to be in awe of nature and of the miracle of our own, of our human bodies and of our intellect and of our emotion, and to live a life of appreciation and openness to all there is to appreciate. And I think that my four children have evolved to that level to a great extent as well. It's a process, of course.
Sure.
And at their respective ages, they've in some ways have a long way to go, just as I still have a long way to go. But I think that's one of the most important messages that I would try to impart to my children, is to be open to life. And the way to do that, of course, is to not expect too much of yourself, unrealistic things of yourself. Otherwise, you spend so much time beating yourself down that you can't be sensitive to the beauty that's around you and all the wonder and awe that there is.
Yet you still push yourself, you still stretch yourself. How do you maintain that balance in yourself?
Well, it's not easy by any means, and I think it's I don't think it's a constant tension. Mm-hmm. Hoping for balance, I think it's a give and take. One time you may go to one extreme and one time to another, and one end of the spectrum or the other, and sometimes you're in between with a balanced tension. I think it's important to maintain a sense of your own pulse, if you will, and to be conscious of what you need at a given time, and to be willing to give yourself some slack once in a while. And I think only in that way, to be conscious of your needs and the conscious for balance, can you really go all out, you know, when you need to.
Run the entire race instead
exactly.
of running out.
Exactly.
Yeah, I call it stretching and supporting. Because I used to just stretch myself, stretch, and there's a point where,
yeah,
you know, you find out that there's a physical reality. But what I learned to do for myself is stretch myself more than anybody else could possibly expect. But then when I'm done, give myself some support, you know, and alternating those has allowed me to expand a bit in my own life. And my interpretation of what I see you doing with yourself is somewhat similar to that. I see you push yourself, but then allow yourself to have that balance. And give yourself, because you stretch yourself, maybe a little more leeway in another area as well.
Right, and there's different frameworks within which to do that, and sometimes you do it within a day.
Right.
And by balancing your sense of solitude.
Yes.
And yet involvement with other people, and then you may balance it over a period of a month or 2 months as well, with taking a week off here to totally change your focus, and yet maybe taking 10 days here to be very intense.
Right.
So I think it's being conscious of where you are at any given time, so that you know what you need, and not just be charging headlong into a circumstance in such a way that you lose sight of what you need.
Or you just said, this is my goal, I'm just going to do this, and never looking at the impact. My daughter Jolie was had an experience where she committed herself to a goal to dance at Disneyland, and she got the dream. She won in competition against 600 other girls. She made a decision on what was most important to her, and what was most important to her was to be able to share and grow and be with her family. I think too often people don't have the courage to reevaluate when they've set a goal and say, right. God, is this what I really want? Yeah, it's what everybody said I wanted. It's what I thought I wanted. And I got the awards and I got the accolades and I got all the respect. But is this really me?
Is this
really what I want? And I'm really proud of her to make that kind of decision for herself and have that kind of view. And I think that's the kind of balance that I think all people can learn. So I'm busy trying to learn from my daughter as well as hopefully be a good coach.
Boy, that's right. I mean, if we quit learning from my kids, we're in trouble, because they really do have a lot to teach us.
Without a doubt. Let me ask you one final question, if I may. You are a real proud resident of Hawaii, and you talk a lot about the aloha spirit. And I know you have some metaphors where you relate that to America as a whole, and I wondered if maybe in our final moments here you could share a little bit about that.
Sure. One of the things that's exciting about living in Hawaii is the ethnic diversity.
Right.
And the fact that the aloha spirit truly lives in spite of that diversity. But I wouldn't say in spite, I'd say maybe because of it, because of the need to get along, the need to appreciate one another's culture, language, tradition, needs. And one of the nice things about living here is that everybody celebrates everybody else's holidays, you know, so you have lots of holidays in Hawaii. But I think that leadership in Hawaii may have a unique challenge, Tony, because Hawaii can in fact be the microcosm of the vision that we should have for the rest of the world. Because of the diversity of our planet, it requires kind of a universal aloha spirit if you will. And I like being here in Hawaii because I think we can truly be on the cutting edge of the vision which is necessary to promote harmony and to consolidate that peace and that harmony and that kind of sense of world ohana, family, if you will. And I think it can start right here in Hawaii, or people can look to Hawaii, and we can make policies, social policies, governmental policies, ecological policies, that can be models for the rest of the world. And I think because of that, it's incumbent upon the leadership of Hawaii to take that challenge seriously.
I lied. I have another question. Ask you one more final question. And that is, I am so touched by who you are as a person, and I feel privileged to have the time and energy and friendship with you. I think there are a few people in my life that have really created mastery, and although you would deny this, I would certainly see you as one of those. And I would really be curious to know that when you do pass on, what do you want to be remembered about Captain Gerald Coffee, or just Jerry Coffee?
Simply that the world is a little better because I was here.
No words could be better said. Mahalo. Thanks for the grace of your company.
Mahalo, Tony. Thank you.
And to all those listening, aloha.